Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org. That's my new website, new a couple months ago anyway, where you can listen to this show any time of day or night thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking about a new film called Turning Prayer into Action, Indigenous Grandmothers Meet the Bioneers. And we will have Indigenous Grandmothers and Bioneers here with us right here at the cafe. Right now, I would like to welcome Alan Roberts and Mary Neuter Roberts, authors of A Saint in the City, Sufi Arts of Urban Senegal, and they're curators of the exhibition that's opening at the Museum of International Folk Art tonight. And Bobby Sumberg is with us. She's a curator at the Museum of International Folk Art. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
Welcome. Good morning.
Hi.
It's great to have you here. This is a very interesting exhibition, A Saint in the City, Sufi Arts of Urban Senegal. Senegal is a predominantly Muslim country. Dakar is the city at the heart of this show. Who's the saint in the city?
The saint in the city is Cheikh Amadou Bamba. He was the founder of one of the four Sufi movements in Senegal called the Mourid Way. He lived from 1853 to 1927, so he lived right through the colonial era when the French came in to take over Senegal. And he's thought to have been a colonial resistor. However, he was a pacifist. He was a deep pacifist. He was also a poet and a mystic and a miracle worker. And he has become a national icon for Senegal. He represents the values and a work ethic and a kind of sense of tolerance and peace that is strived for by young people in Senegal today.
And he has many followers today. Did he have lots of followers in his lifetime?
That began rather slowly because the French really discouraged people from following him. The French were, in a lot of ways, frightened of the charisma of the man and the kind of ways that he had of really helping people to overcome the early difficulties of the colonial period. People really kind of coalesced around him. So as a consequence of that, the French sent him into exile two different times, once for 7 years right at the turn of the 20th century to Gabon. Actually, they sent him to a penal colony in Lambaréné, which was the town where Albert Schweitzer would end up working some years later. And then they brought him back and sent him into exile in Mauritania and brought him back again to Senegal, but kept him in house under house arrest the rest of his life. So in the meantime, as often happens when someone is being persecuted in a way like that, rather than having it be a positive effect for the colonizers, it backfired, and he was seen as a martyr and someone who was so peaceful in his resistance that he really made a mockery of what the French were trying to do in the first place. So many, many people joined around him, and that movement continues really with great enthusiasm. There are several million people outside of Senegal as well as the millions in Senegal that follow his movement. And again, it's, as Polly said, because of his sense of tolerance for different religions and different perspectives, but also because of the way that he taught people that in a harsh setting like Senegal, where there are no evident natural resources other than human energy, people have to work hard to make a living, and that work itself is then a form of prayer. It is one of those things that if... as he said, if you have to work the whole day through and can't even take time off for praying, it's far better to work to feed your family than it is even to pray to God. So that is a very inspiring message that has carried people through difficult times and continues to do so, both in Senegal and abroad.
It's hard to imagine how his message would be such a threat to the colonial power.
Well, the colonizers wanted things to go their way, and France is at least sort of a Catholic country. There's a whole history of resistance to the Catholic Church in France as well. But the idea was that the colonizing mission would certainly be Catholic and follow a kind of Western model And Bamba came in, as did other Muslim leaders, with a very distinctly alternative model to that, which the French felt was threatening to their entire enterprise in northern Africa as well as West Africa. They were really fearful that there would be a kind of coordinated resistance through Islam to what they were trying to do as colonizers. So there was a period when they really tried to suppress any kind of popular Islam. That didn't last all that long because it was such an obvious failure. And they actually turned around and tried to co-opt Islam after that by a sort of divide and conquer strategy of trying to create small Muslim groups that wouldn't be coordinated with each other and would sort of resist each other and kind of rule in that way.
We're talking about the exhibition A Saint in the City, Sufi Arts of Urban Senegal, which opens tonight at the Museum of International Folk Art. Now, there's only one photograph of this saint, and that appears as imagery in all of the art that you see in this exhibition.
That's right. There was one photograph taken of Amadou Bamba by the French, almost like a mugshot. It was published in a book in 1917. The photograph was taken in 1913. And in this photograph, Amadou Bamba, the saint, is standing in front of a mosque, and he is wearing an entirely white robe from head to ankle, and you see very little of him. His face is very shadowed because the sun was very hot that afternoon, and the camera was probably just slightly out of focus, and so the robe is luminescent. And it creates this very mysterious photograph, which, interestingly enough, has become the catalyst for an explosion of artistic imagery in Senegal. And that's really what this exhibition is about, is this dynamic visual culture that has existed in Senegal over the past 30-plus years that is inspired almost exclusively by this one and only photograph that has really been transformed from a mugshot into a blessed icon.
And it's amazing because in some photographs, you can sort of tell the essence of a person through their eyes and through their face. In this one, you can barely make out features.
It's true, and yet it subscribes to a Sufi aesthetic and a Sufi philosophy perfectly because there is a belief in Sufism that for every visible reality, there's a hidden side called batin. And so in a sense, this photograph, it incorporates, it embodies the mysteries or what are called the aya or signs from God. And Sufis will spend hours endlessly discussing and debating the meaning of the particular motifs in this photograph. And artists then play and riff on those motifs through their paintings, through their artworks, by kind of expanding on the imagery.
Now, Islamic art usually doesn't have representational imagery in it. Sufi art is different?
It's one of those questions that really needs to be addressed right from the beginning, because people feel that there's a kind of reticence, if not an anathema, to imagery in Islam, whereas that actually is not true at all. People will say that, and you could talk to Muslims in Senegal who would say that just as they were standing in front of a painting of Amadou Bamba, for instance, and say, oh, we don't do that. The fact is that there's no mention in the Quran of this kind of reticence or this sort of resistance to imagery. And the history of Islam is just replete with great examples of different artistry, portraiture, and other kinds of artistry, including our present times. Every time that you look at the New York Times or another newspaper that might be portraying some scene in Iran or Iraq, you'll see that photography is just hugely, hugely important, and that holy people and political figures are shown in great profusion. And yet, at the same time, people will tell you that, oh, we really don't feel that it's appropriate to show the human figure. So there's just a real paradox there. And the fact is that people feel that these are photographs that are revealing hidden truths, as Polly was saying. So it's one of those things where we have to sort of understand what it is that people are doing even though it might be a medium like photography that we understand in a different way, it's that they're deconstructing it and using it in ways that we might not be so familiar with.
So one walks through the exhibition and sees so many different ways of representing the image of Amadou Bamba from this same photograph. Are these images, these artworks themselves, thought to have power?
They definitely are thought to have what is called baraka, or blessing energy. It's a kind of potent energy or power that brings well-being to people, that blesses their lives, that inspires them, that gives them courage. And in Sufism, the tombs, the writings, and the images, if there are any, of saints, all can bring baraka to devotees. So what you see in Senegal today is workplaces and shops and businesses, and also homes, and the city streets are just saturated with images of Amadou Bamba, and also occasionally with images of the founders of some of the other Sufi movements in Senegal, but not nearly as pervasively as the image of Sheikh Amadou Bamba. So it's true that what the exhibition does is to capture sort of some of the major art forms that you see in Senegal that range from street painting, like murals, to icons that people use in their homes, to calligraphic representations, and to dress. Also, song and dance are represented in the exhibition, as well as the work of contemporary artists.
On some level, I think somewhere in the catalog, you in your essay, you compared this image to the Virgin of Guadalupe.
Yes, because these images really seem so different, and yet if one were to look across religions, so for instance, with the Virgin of Guadalupe, looking at Catholicism as it's practiced on the ground by people who revere that particular image as a source of blessing, you can find that virtually every religion has this kind of opportunity for people to be blessed visually and then to have a kind of presence in their home. There's a kind of way that we might say certain religions certainly don't have that kind of thing, like Protestant denominations in the United States, for instance, which is simply not true. There's an author named David Morgan who's written a book called Visual Piety, all about evangelical use of images of Christ, especially the paintings of Warner Salmon from the 1940s, that are an active presence. People want them in their homes. They want them specifically near the doorway to bless and protect the home. And the image of the Virgin of Guadalupe is similar to that, where people want the image in their places where they're working and where they're living and on their bodies as tattoos and whatever else, specifically so that their every step is protected and promoted by the Spirit. So this is something that the image of Bamba does for Mourids as well, that there's just a way that people want it around, and that it's an active source of good, even for people like a lot of us who might go to Dakar or somewhere else in Senegal and be wandering around and not even know what the image represented, who that was, or anything else. Mourids feel that they're doing good by just putting it out in a place where it can bless everyone. Whether or not they know who it is doesn't make any difference, because the blessing is still going on.
Something I always wonder, when a scholar goes abroad and sees something like this, and there's really a what you might call mystical or magical transaction happening in the mind of the people, do you see it that way, or do you see, there are the natives who think this thing? I mean, to what extent is this real for you?
This project has been very personal for both of us. It began actually the year before we were married, and it has been sustained through the past 13 years. It all started actually when Al was brought in as a consultant by the Museum of International Folk Art for the exhibition Recycled, Reseen. And he was sent to Senegal to do a video on a case study in a junkyard called Coloban in Dakar. And I accompanied him on that trip in June of 1994, and it was while we were standing in that junkyard that we noticed this extraordinary monumental mural showing Sheikh Amadou Bamba praying on the water which is one of his most significant miracles. And we began to pose questions, and little by little, that was the moment that really set this project in motion. And from that point on, we have probably been there now over 20 times. Every summer, sometimes twice a year, we go to Senegal to do our research. We've taken our two boys with us every summer. They've really grown up with their summers in Senegal. It's like a second home to us. We have very, very close friends. And while we have not converted to Islam, I would say that we certainly subscribe to the values of the Mourid way, in the same way that we also value many different religions in the world and many different spiritual traditions. We're scholars of spiritual traditions, and so part of our work is to understand them and to communicate them to others. So it's kind of somewhere in between being part of it and just simply admiring it from a distance.
And what I would add is that when we write about this particular movement, or when we have put together the exhibition or participate in other activities, we're always working with people who are in the movement itself. And really our point is to try to bring their first voices to bear, so that we're not interpreting them. We're not using distancing words like "they believe" or something like that. We're really trying to present this as a truth, because it certainly is true to Mourids. We ourselves, as Polly mentions, do subscribe to some of it, and really feel that the intentionality, if nothing else, is true to what we believe in this world as well. So it's one of those things that it's a kind of interesting position to be in as a scholar, because we were trained to distance ourselves. I was trained in anthropology, and supposedly I would step back and look at the natives from a distance. And I stopped doing that a long time ago, because I don't think that that's an appropriate thing to be doing in the first place. And it just seems as though this project in particular has given us opportunities to really forefront what people want known about them. That's how we've done the exhibition from the start, is to ask people, both in Senegal, and actually we work very closely with the Senegalese community in Los Angeles through the course of the exhibition. And our first question was always, what would you like people to know about you? And we would explain how the exhibition would be in museums in the United States, and that there would be a lot of school kids coming through, and one thing or another, what would they like to know? What would they like these children or other people to know about them as Senegalese, them as Muslims? What would they like them to know about Sheikh Amadou Bamba? What would they like them to know about Islam in general? Because they're acutely aware of how little Americans know about Islam, and how fearful they are of what we hear about Islam through the government.
We're talking to Alan Roberts and Mary Neuter Roberts. And the exhibition, which is opening tonight at the Museum of International Folk Art, is called A Saint in the City, Sufi Arts of Urban Senegal. You said a few moments ago, when you were talking about the life of Sheikh Amadou Bamba, that they had to work so hard in Senegal that work became a form of prayer. But what are their other practices? Do they have temples? Do they do things in the home? What's the actual nature of the practice besides work?
Well, first of all, as devotees, they do spend a lot of time in prayer. Also, much time is spent singing what are called the Hasayids. These are the odes. The odes that are based on Bamba's writings. We should let you know that Bamba was a prolific poet. He was said to have written over 7 metric tons of verse. And ink literally spilled from his fingers. And this is the irony of his exiles and of his persecution, is that he was a pacifist and a poet. And his poetry is beautiful. It's something like the verses of the Quran, but it's also very particular to his worldview.
And translations of it appear in the exhibition.
And tracts of his writings can be found in Wolof, in French, and in English, all over Senegal. And what devotees do is to put those verses to song. So much time is spent singing the Hasayids. Even when people are working, they'll sing. Also, every year there's a great pilgrimage called the Magal to Touba, which is the holy pilgrimage city where Bamba is buried. And there's an extraordinary mosque there. And it's a very holy city. It's the second largest city in Senegal. And it's really every Mourid's dream to end up in Senegal, to live out their final days in Senegal, I mean in Touba, and to be buried there. Many Mourids travel the world. They're very international business people. In almost any major city in the world, you'll find a Mourid community. They say that in New York alone, there's somewhere between 20 and 40,000 Mourids. Of course, there's a whole neighborhood in Harlem called Little Senegal. But even the Mourids who travel the world and are always on the move, they still go constantly back and forth, both to Dakar and to Touba, because Touba is sacred space. That's the ultimate destination.
When you have a religion that is based on the life of a saint, and that saint now has been dead for 80 years, probably nobody alive now remembers him, or almost nobody. How does a religion, how does a practice change when that person becomes memory and no longer sort of a living person?
Well, I think, first of all, we were very fortunate because we did meet some elderly people who had seen the saint when they were children.
When they were young. There are
these stories that are fairly direct, or there are a lot of people whose parents conveyed stories to them, and their parents may be passed away now, but the stories kind of live on. But I don't think that anyone in Senegal would say that Bamba is dead in the same way that we might say someone is dead. It's true, of course, that he passed away and that his body lies in state in Touba. But the fact is that he's a living presence, and the stories about him are ongoing. The hagiography, the sort of history of a saint, is one that is always in the present, because people are telling stories that they need to hear and that include the sorts of hopes that they have for life, or the needs that they experience as the world changes. So contemporary life is always folded into this storytelling, and Bamba is there as a guiding presence. So people feel that he's here, and in particular, through the images, he's in a room where the images are present.
And I would add to that that there's a lot of emphasis in Sufism on the descendants of saints as well. And so his five sons and his daughters all played important roles in the history of the Mourid movement and still do. The current caliph in Touba is one of Bamba's sons, the only remaining son. And after the death of this particular Serigne Saliou, because he's already in his 70s, then there will be the moment when power transfers to the next generation. That will be a very significant moment in the history of the Mourid movement. But there are many thousands of grandchildren of Bamba, and there's a lot of prestige associated with your closeness to Bamba genealogically, just as there's considerable prestige associated with Bamba's closeness or proximity to God, because what a saint is called in Arabic is Wali Allah, which means a friend of God, and it implies someone who has come very, very close to God himself. So each descendant is kind of a step removed from that closeness.
At the beginning of the program, when you were talking about Sheikh Amadou Bamba's role in resisting French colonialism. Now you have a post-colonial, what you call trans-colonial society. What is the role of this religion in dealing with the political situation, the social situation that you have in Senegal and Dakar today?
Well, first of all, the president of Senegal, Abdoulaye Wade, is a fervent Mourid, so he's somebody that follows this particular mystical Islamic movement. And that is significant because he then brings the values of hard work and that sort of perspective to bear on international politics. He's been a very active internationalist, as a matter of fact, working closely with Thabo Mbeki in South Africa and the new government in Nigeria on an international program for African Renaissance. So he brings those Mourid values into an international perspective, but then on a day-to-day basis, there is this very, very exciting and active diaspora, always moving outward from Senegal and back towards Senegal, in a kind of pulsing movement. There are murids to be found just about everywhere in the world. I would imagine there are some in Santa Fe in small business circumstances, like, for instance, the flea market or wherever. There are very likely to be murids passing through or resident in this area. Certainly a town as big as a city as big as Albuquerque would have some. And the fact is that they're everywhere selling all sorts of goods, but also bringing their professional values to bear, because a lot of them are very highly educated people working in all sorts of professional sectors in the United States. But the thing about that is that a diaspora implies a kind of casting of people outward from a center, whereas this is a diaspora that always moves back to the center. So people that are in the United States would long to go back to Senegal for the Magal, for the pilgrimage, and many of them do go back every single year for this kind of coming together at Touba that brings something like 2 to 3 million people to one place. It's quite extraordinary what's going on in terms of the devotion that that represents, but it's also one of the biggest marketplaces there's ever been. It's a very active kind of festival of buying and selling and seeing your friends and getting together with relatives, and then you go back out into the world. So it's a kind of coming and going like that that motivates people, and it is this kind of sense of feeling that as you go out into the world, you're bringing the values of tolerating people around you and making money. Very ardent entrepreneurs.
Unfortunately, we're running out of time, but I would like to turn to Bobby Sumberg, who has been sitting very quietly this whole time, but she has made this whole thing happen here in Santa Fe. This is a traveling exhibition that started at the University of California at Los Angeles, and it's here now, opening tonight. Tell us about the opening and some of the events surrounding it.
Mm-hmm. I will. Yes, the opening is tonight. It's from 5:30 to 8. And what I'd also like to emphasize is that admission is free tonight, so you can come on up and enjoy the exhibit. Enjoy also the other exhibits. The whole museum will be open tonight. At 6 o'clock, Polly and Ellen will be giving a talk on the exhibit and on the subject of Amadou Bamba and Sufism in Senegal. And that I would recommend getting there and getting your seat reserved, because I'm sure it will be popular. During the summer, there are a few other programs that are going on. And our Arts Alive program, which is a free hands-on workshops for all ages. You can just come outside on the plaza on Tuesday, July 24th and Thursday, July 26th. They'll be printing Adinkra banners, which is a little less relevant to Satan the City, but more to the Needles and Pins exhibit. But then on Tuesday, the 31st of July, and August 2nd, which is a Thursday, there will be a workshop in reverse glass painting, so you can come up and learn how it's done. And you will see a lot of reverse glass painting in the exhibit, so it's a great tie-in.
So all this and much, much more we can find out on the website, moifa.org, M-O-I-F-A, Museum of International Folk Art. And I wanted to say more clearly that the exhibition originated at the Fowler Museum of Cultural History at UCLA, curated by Alan Roberts and Mary Neuter Roberts, who you can hear tonight at the museum.
At 6.
Thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And thank you, Bobby. We'll see you soon again.
Okay.
We're going to take a little break right now. We will be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. And I'd like now to welcome Cynthia Jures. She is a film producer of the film Turning Prayer into Action, Indigenous Grandmothers Meet the Bioneers. It's a film for Link TV. And grandmother Margaret Behan, who is in that movie as well. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's great to be here.
Tell us about this film and how it came about. Who are these? Who are you all? Who are these Indigenous grandmothers, and how did this all come to be?
Well, I'll start, and then Margaret, you can say something too. I met the grandmothers here in Santa Fe in 2005. They were here for their second council gathering, and I was reminded of a vision or idea that I had had 25 years ago, to use satellite technology to connect the elders in prayer and ceremony for the earth. And when I met the grandmothers, I felt like they had already started to gather and devote themselves to their prayers for the earth and for the healing of the earth in these times, and that we really ought to do this. So I approached them and received their blessing to go ahead and organize what we call a space bridge between the grandmothers in Dharamsala, where they were last October for their fourth council gathering, and link them via satellite to the Bioneers Conference, which was occurring at the very same time in California. So we did this dialogue of prayer into action over the three evenings of the Bioneers Conference and filmed that as well, and are now putting that into an hour-long program for Link TV. And Link TV is a independent, non-commercial television network.
Link TV is what public TV used to be when I was a little kid.
That's right. Yeah, it's like free TV. It's completely, you know, in these days, uncontrolled by the corporate media.
Exactly.
So,
and the film is not only going to be on Link TV, but it's screening tomorrow night, Friday, at 7 o'clock at the Armory for the Arts right here in Santa Fe. Grandmother Margaret, you are part of this Council of Indigenous Grandmothers. How did you come together? Who are members of this? How many of you are you, and where are you from?
I'm a Cheyenne, and I'm from Montana, Lame Deer, Montana, and I am one of the 13 grandmothers on this council, and we began in 2004 in Phoenicia, New York. We were called together by the Center of Sacred Studies. They sent out 17 letters to Indigenous women that were in their tribe healing, tribal ceremony leaders. And so I got a letter, and I went to this gathering, and 13 of us showed up. And so it has been the Council of the 13. As you know, there are 13 planets, there are 13 moons, and this number is special in my ceremony, as the 13 star rays, starburst that I use.
Now, these are all North American Indigenous people, or from other parts of the planet?
No, they're from other parts of the planet, from Africa to Nepal.
Tibet.
We have Tibet, five grandmothers from North America.
Okay.
Two grandmothers are from Brazil. One is from the Arctic Circle, one from Tibet, one from Mexico, one from Nepal, and one from Africa, and then the five from North America.
Yeah, the Hopi grandmother, Mona, the Takalma grandmother, which is from Oregon, Agnes, and then the two Lakota grandmothers, our sisters from Ogallala, from South Dakota.
And so what do you do when you meet together?
So I'm the Cheyenne grandmother, and when we meet together, we have had a private council the first 3 days, and we talk about what we are doing in our village or our communities. And we have, there are five of us grandmothers that have medicines that we use for our ceremonies. And so we talk about what is happening in our community where we live. Like right now is very important. We're all alert. The whole world is the climate change and water. Water is has always been respected and been a medicine to our people. And then seeing how the world is coming to this, that water is going to be as important as oil, you know. So we buy water. And my grandfather had said that one day we're going to be buying water. And now...
And everybody laughed.
Yes, they all laughed. And now I'm his granddaughter, and I'm buying water. So water is our number one topic that we've been talking about. Last week we were in council in the Black Hills in South Dakota, and so the water is very important. And the number one topic we talk about in council, and there are a lot of people that are very interested in helping us. So we're looking at all these proposals, and meeting with pioneers is very important to us because we are in the same it's like a marriage, you know. They believe in helping this planet, and we are too. We're very concerned about it as grandmothers for our grandchildren and great-grandchildren. As in my grandparents would pray about the ones that are still coming. And so we talk about educating the next seven generations, and we want them to have this planet to be healthy and living in.
So the grandmothers have formed this council, and, you know, traditionally, if I may say, I think the grandmother's role is at home.
Oh, yeah.
But now, with what is happening in the world, the grandmothers have seen many things, as we all have, and have decided to come forward and dedicate themselves to praying and educating all of us to wake up.
Yeah.
You know, so they not only talk in the council, but they also do ceremonies and offer prayers. When they meet in their councils, they have three ceremonies a day, morning, noon, and night, and they are it's a very intense gathering.
Each one from one of the different traditions of
we all take turns setting up our altars and praying, and auspicious things happen when we are all together.
Like what?
Like last night, for example, it was thunderstorm and the light show and the rainbow in the night. So we also had people that came and wanted us to bless a child. So all the grandmothers got to hold this child. And people come over and ask us for prayer. And that's what we are, for prayer. We're the connection to the spirit. We work with spirit. That's what I understand from the pioneers and the grandmothers. It's like a marriage. The pioneers are about action, and the grandmothers are about prayer. So we're working together in Santa Fe.
So when you talk about turning prayer into action, talk about, Cynthia, the action part of it.
Well, as probably many people are aware, Bioneers was started here in Santa Fe and 18 years ago this year, and is very much focused on solutions to all of the various problems and issues that we are so aware of in these times. And so rather than focusing on how awful it is, Bioneers is really dedicated to finding those solutions and bringing out the people from out of the woodwork, you know, so to speak, who are really doing wonderful, wonderful things to...
And they do incredible things. They do things you can't even believe.
Well, yeah. For example, Paul Stamets is a researcher in working with mushrooms.
I know. That's one of my favorite ones.
Yeah.
To oil spill eating mushrooms.
That's right. Right. So he's learning... He's figured out how to clean up polluted waters and toxic waste dumps using mushrooms, growing mushroom spores on these locations, and then lo and behold, they become, you know, fertile again.
Right.
So there's things like that that Bioneers always features, and now Bioneers is also, after focusing for many, many years on really the biological, ecological issues, they are now branching into also the social issues and issues around social justice, and realizing that in order for the environment to become sustainable, we people have to have sustainable relations, and we have to heal those relations. And so the healing is really not just the earth, but all of us together. And so we have to meet in that place where our personal lives as human beings are being addressed in a healing way, as well as the environment. So it's all working together. And I think the grandmothers, one of the things that happened on the space bridge last year was looking at how we can heal our relations between the oppressed people of this world, the indigenous people, and also people of color, the issues around diversity, and also the youth, you know, young people who are feeling very disoriented, and what do we do, you know. So we were really getting into all of that, and it was very deeply moving and empowering. So this is kind of, the grandmothers are healers, they're women of prayer, but they're also healers. And so this is the opportunity, you know, that they are offering. And I think Bioneers is, and many of us are craving a sort of rootedness, a refuge in something kind of larger than ourselves in these times, a prayer and a way of being that holds a big picture during all of this change that we're experiencing.
As for Cheyenne grandmother, I come from the Cheyenne people of this North America. And I say on this movie, you know, the Cheyenne have survived genocide. So we are working now. I work in my community on being self-reliant, self-sufficient. And there's a lot of oppression. I mean, we know oppression very well in this beautiful mother country.
Indeed.
So it's a very, very difficult, very painful.
I mean, there was something that really struck me when I was watching last night an edit of this film, which is screening tomorrow night. It's called Turning Prayer into Action, Indigenous Grandmothers Meet the Bioneers, and it's screening tomorrow night at the Armory for the Arts at 7 o'clock. And that is, there are people in the film who are just, their hearts are wide open. They want to be healed. And it seems to me there's always this what I see as a big problem, because the people who really need to be healed don't show up at these things. They're the ones who are doing the oppression, you know, the Dick Cheney's or whoever, you know, name your person. They're not going to show up. They couldn't care less about being healed. How does the work affect the people who are really the perpetrators of the violence and the pollution and the bad stuff that's happening on this planet?
Well, as an addiction counselor, I believe in the trickle effect. If I affect one person, which is my daughter, my grandchildren, starting with my family, then my neighbors, my tribe, the people that I'm here with, the grandmothers, I'm here with the pioneers, I'm in Santa Fe. So the trickle effect is happening. I have hope in that. And the youth, because I know it works.
It's a good question, because I've had that same question, is how is this, let's say, prayer going to really affect change? And what I've come to is just that we don't always know how change is going to happen, and we can't always measure or see what the effects of our actions or our intentions are. But if we cultivate a good heart and a clear mind and a caring with each other and with the earth, you know, and we start, as Margaret says, with each other, with what we know is right in front of us, but we offer that out to the whole earth, who knows how change is going to really happen? And we have to do it. We have to start somewhere. So this is really the intention, and to have that kind of trust and faith in something larger than ourselves, and that we are not, you know, we don't always have to see every result right away.
Grandmother Margaret, I was wondering, when you met all these other grandmothers, and each of you did your ceremonies, did the ceremonies and your ways of practicing and praying have things in common with one another? Did you feel at home with these other ceremonies?
Yes, and we even invite each other to join in our ceremony. And that was very comfortable. But yet we respected each other. And I think that was really powerful, the way the Tibetan grandmother has her altar set up, and also the Hopi grandmother. So we all had this understanding already, and we knew we were all included. So it is similar but different. But the main thing that is there is the respect for each other. Never cross the line, you know, for the Takama grandmother when she is doing her prayers.
So. Cynthia, how long were you working on this film?
Let's see. I think I started putting it together, it must have been 2005, for about a year. I was brewing on it and kind of thinking about how this would all work, talking with Bioneers and Link TV. And then in May of 2006, I went to the third council gathering, which was held in Oaxaca, Mexico, at the home of Grandmother Julieta. And at that time, made a presentation to the council formally to ask them if they were interested in doing this. And they said yes. So that was in May of 2006. And in October of 2006, we were in Dharamsala for the fourth council gathering. And so it was between May and October that we really pulled it all together. So it was,
and that's where you set up this space bridge that appears in the film, where you have one set of people in Dharamsala, the other set of people in the United States, talking to one another through video satellite transmission.
That's right.
So all of this can be experienced, ladies and gentlemen, tomorrow night at the Armory for the Arts here in Santa Fe on Old Pecos Trail. It's the world premiere screening, and it's a benefit for the International Council of 13 Indigenous Grandmothers. So it's tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, Turning Prayer into Action, Indigenous Grandmothers Meet the Bioneers. Cynthia Jures is the film producer, and Grandmother Margaret Behan is in the film and is one of the Indigenous Grandmothers. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show any time of day or night, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features Artist of the Month, Clifford Brown. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.